This episode of the Sit Down is powered by Thrive Fantasy. Are you into props? Do you like betting fantasy football? Are you ready for football? Thrive Fantasy has you covered. With Thrive, you can eliminate the countless hours of research and focus on only the top tier athletes that have the biggest impact on the game. Who the hell wants to worry about bench warmers and that kind of stuff? We can worry just about the top tier guys. And if you love props, this is definitely for you. What you do is you choose 10 out of the 20 available player props to build your lineup. Each prop is assigned a fantasy value for both the over and under based on how likely it is to hit. You hit the most props and you rack up the most points to win big shares of prize pools. Keep in mind, Thrive Fantasy has over 140,000 guaranteed in prizes for NFL Week 1. NFL Week 1 is coming. We're about a month away from the NFL season. And Thrive Fantasy wants to award you with over that and a ton of money as the season gets going. Thrive also features 100K guaranteed contests, and it's just $20 to enter, and first place takes home $20,000. I urge you, if you enjoy the Sit Down, if you enjoy football, go check out a brand new app, Thrive Fantasy, and if you use promo code Sit Down when you sign up today, you're going to get 100% instant deposit as a bonus. Up to $100. So if you put up $100, they're going to give you $100 and you can play that for free on Thrive Fantasy. If you like player props, I love player props. It's a sport app for you. Don't do the general, just fantasy apps. Go check out Thrive today. Get in the game. Again, promo code Sit Down when you sign up today and you receive 100% instant first deposit match up to $100. Get involved. Thrive Fantasy.
Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome into another edition of The Sit Down, an organized crime podcast. I hope you're having a great day wherever you are. We are back with another episode, another big show. We have actually a really big show, a lot going on in the mob world. We've got some news to get into. We've got a Q&A, got some great questions, and we're going to do a biography today. We're going to talk about John Martorano. We've talked about John a little bit before. We talked about him on the Whitey Bulger episode. For anyone that knows, John Martorano was the chief enforcer for the Winter Hill Gang for, you know, a long time. He killed a lot of people. He got away with most of it. Let's just be honest with ourselves. And I think the big question always is about John Martorano. And I've said this before. Look, a rat is a rat. We've talked about that time and time again. It doesn't matter why you cooperate. If you cooperate, you are a rat. Now, when we look at John Martorano, the question is, do you blame John Martorano for why he cooperated? And we'll get a really great quote out of him out of it. He actually talked about this on an interview that he did. So we'll talk about all that and more. But The big news coming out of the gate is this Colombo bust. For anyone that doesn't know, this morning, Tuesday, September 14th, the boss of the Colombo crime family, Andrew Mush Russo, who is 87 years old, the underboss, the Colombo crime family, and multiple other individuals, including Teddy Persico, were jammed up. And look, this is big because the Colombo crime family, as we've talked about, is really on its last legs. It is the weakest of the five families. And, you know, it's really been a complete mess for a long time. Obviously, we talked about it during the Persico episode and, you know, the Greg Scarp episode. I mean, the Colombo crime family is really, again, on its last legs. And, you know, these charges are not good for Russo. Russo's 87 years old. It involves union corruption, money laundering, loan sharking, drug trafficking, construction safety stuff. I mean, all sorts of things. And when we look at some of the quotes coming out of it, it is not good. Not only is Mush Russo under indictment, but the consigliere of the family, the underboss, really the governing body of the Colombo crime family is jammed up. And there's four captains, just all sorts of people. And when you hear some of the stuff coming out of this affidavit, I mean, in one instance, one of the individuals involved really makes some, let's just be honest, some really terrible quotes in a wiretap. At one point, Captain Vincent Ricciardi said to a union head, "I'll put him in the ground right in front of his wife and kids, right in front of his fucking house. You will laugh at all you want. I'm not afraid to go to jail, pal. Let me tell you something. To prove a point, I would fucking shoot him right in front of his wife and kids. Call the police. Fuck it. Let me go. How long do you think I'm going to last anyway?" Not good. Obviously, if you know anything about Ricciardo, he is a big union delegate. This isn't good. This is bad stuff. All these guys are pretty old, particularly Mush Russo. He also made comments, Ricciardi, that "I'm going to put an administrative assistant in there with you. He's a legitimate guy. You're going to have a trustee meeting. You're going to hire him as an administrative assistant, whatever the fuck you do, and he's going to call the shot." So basically, look, he was in control of this union. You know, look, this is bad. We don't have a lot of information on this, but all in all, there's a lot of charges here. The feds are still, whether you think it should be going on or not, the feds are still looking at the mob. We know in Philadelphia, there was a bust last year, 2 years ago. Those individuals are about to go to trial. This is likely the end for Russo. I mean, Mush Russo has been, he's been in and out of prison since 1980. I think he's only been out for like 6 or 7 years since 1986. He's been inside a lot. He came home in, I think, 2013, and he's been out ever since. But, this is it, I think, for not only Ricciardi, but the consigliere, the underboss, and Mush Russo. So this could put a death knell in the Colombo crime family. It's just that simple. They've been in complete dissent for a long time. So this isn't surprising, but we'll definitely stay up and all over the story as it continues. Great reporting by our friend Larry McShane, who we had on the show a couple of weeks ago. I do also want to say, I was going to talk a little bit today about the James Galanti documentary, but we will get into that next week. Obviously, I think, I just want to spend a little bit more time on it. We have a lot going on today. I'm going to just come out and say it. Like, James Galanti was definitely someone that was connected to the mob, particularly with Matty Iannello. And we're going to do a show on Matty Iannello pretty soon, so I might just save it for then. But I'd highly tell you right now that it's a really interesting documentary. He definitely was connected. I likened him to Dick Barone. If you've ever seen Sopranos, he was part of waste management. He obviously paid a street tax to Matt Iannello, and he was basically goaded into doing it. Iannello was there in case he needed him. And look, it ended up long-term getting Matty Iannello jammed up, and he went to prison over it. But look, it's not like, James Galanti wasn't, Anthony Casso or Roy DeMeo or anything. He was an associate. He made money and the mob shook him down. Pretty simple. Iannello got a nice envelope every couple of months from this guy. So we'll get into that a little bit down the road, but I don't want to spoil it for anyone because I know it is a fairly new documentary. But let's get into the Q&A, and then we'll get into John Martirano. I'm sure people ask where Blackjack is. Blackjack was in Vegas, and he mentioned to me that he was ready to do the show Tuesday, and then he mentioned he can't do it. So I'm kind of on my own, but, it is what it is. I wasn't able to get a fill-in for it. But, look, I've done these shows with guests before. I don't think I've ever done it alone, but we'll get by. We'll do fine. Let's get into the Q&A. And, look, someone complained about the Q&A the other night because – we don't, quote, put where the biography starts. Look, in every show, we do put it there, and it will remain there. I like to involve the audience. I think it's a great way to have a connection to our audience. We always have great questions. So, going forward, obviously the great thing about podcasts is you can fast forward into what parts you want. We obviously have to grow the show a little bit. I think it becomes monotonous if we just come on here every day and go right into the biography. And look, some of the biographies that we do are not as long as others. So, for instance, I kind of had the show planned out, and Blackjack, I knew wasn't going to be around or likely wouldn't be on the show. And I felt like, I want him around for the Rizzuto episode. So I figured, let's do a shorter biography tonight. We'll throw a Q&A in. We had this news that popped up. So, I felt like it was a good time to do Martirano. And I've been wanting to do John for a while. A lot of people in Boston and up in the New England area ask about it. So I figured, let's do it. Before we do that, let's get into the Q&A. We have some great questions tonight, and I'm ready to jump into them. All right. First one. It's from my good friend, Comandante Kirk. Is there any information or examples of crossover between the Italian families and international organization on drugs? Drug trafficking always seems like a complicated issue, but when it happens, I feel like I never hear of a family collaborating with another larger organization. Well, look, during the, as we mentioned in the Galanti episode, the French Connection was very much involved with the Corsicans. Obviously, large-scale trafficking organizations over there. As far as have they ever dealt with like Pablo Escobar or cartels or anything? Not that I know of. Obviously, there's a lot of connections into Sicily and into Italy. And obviously, if you know anything about the Sicilian Mafia or the 'Ndrangheta or the Camorra or any of these groups, they are large-scale transnational organizations. As far as the Italian Mafia, who do they do business with? They're obviously doing business with obviously large-scale individuals. But the only known connection that I would have to like a large organization that the Mafia deals with here would obviously be Italy and then, you know, the Corsicans during the Pizza Connection. But yeah, I don't know of any situations where like cartels or anything like that were involved. Hopefully I answered your question. If you had to be a part of any family, what family would it be and why? I feel like I've answered this one before. For me, it would be the Genovese crime family. Whether you believe it or not, I consider myself pretty smart. I consider myself kind of intellectual. I feel like I could be good in a family that obviously is kind of the Ivy League of Cosa Nostra. Look, I'm not in the mafia. I've never been in the mafia and I don't plan to ever be in it. For me, it's just about history and that kind of thing. But, you know, the Genoveses, I always found to be pretty respectable. I always loved Tony Salerno. I feel like it would have been great to work under him. So, you know, if I could be in any group of any family, it would be the Palma Boys with Tony Salerno, 100%. You know, Giganti was obviously really smart and really cunning, but like, I don't know. I would just kind of get sick and tired of like the whole crazy act and that sort of thing. Look, I feel like it would have been fascinating to work under Gotti, you know, and be a part of that crew. I've always been really interested in like the fat Andy Ruggianos and the Faticos and the Don Pizzonias and those kind of guys. So I would probably say the problem they have with John, though, obviously, is his, you know, penchant for being in public. But yeah, I would probably say the Genovese family, probably under Tony Salerno and the Palma Boys. I think I would have done quite well. Maybe under Neil in the Ravenite. All right. Not to take away from any future episodes, but why does it seem like people do not hold Frank Costello in high regard? From all accounts, he seemed to live up to his title as the Prime Minister of the Underworld and was beyond petty street violence with the bottom line first. Yeah, look, I think the growing thing is, if you know anything about the mob or know anything about mob history, I think you should obviously for sure hold Frank Costello in high regard. Not a lot of people know that much about Frank Costello, but look, at one time, you know, Frank Costello was one of the biggest earners in the mafia. I mean, especially when it came to when Lucky takes over the family after the Masseria and Maranzano stuff. I mean, Frank was the consigliere. Frank was making a ton of money for the modern day Genovese crime family. I mean, he literally controlled every slot machine in New York City. I mean, it's pretty incredible. And then when Fiorello LaGuardia confiscated them, what does he do? He goes down to New Orleans and, you know, cuts them in on, you know, 10% and, you know, cleans up there. He had huge political connections. He had huge government connections. He was, as far as political connections, I don't know if there was anyone higher. You know, ultimately, you know, Vito Genovese was just a complete psychopath, and he decided to try to take him out, and Frank just got the message and kind of moved. At the end of the day, power and influence were big, and he knew that, and he was absolutely huge with that kind of stuff. You know, I think when you look at him, I mean, I think people knock someone like him, but then they love Meyer Lansky. And it's like, well, you know, was he Meyer Lansky? No, but I mean, he was in similar regard. I mean, he had a ton of influence, and him and Lansky were really close. And you look at some of these like quote unquote street guys, like the Galantis and the Genoveses, they hated Frank Costello. I would much rather be aligned with a Frank Costello as opposed to Galanti, complete nutcases. The nutcases ultimately didn't really work. Look, Frank Costello, you know, at the end of the day, died in his house. You know, Neil Della Croce died in his house. You know, all these guys that did it the right way. You look at, Scotto, who died a couple of weeks ago. I mean, that's a guy. He wasn't really in the streets. He was in the high ends of the mob, you know, died on his own. You know, all these guys had much more success than these street guys, ultimately. Not that there's anything wrong with the street guy. I mean, there's a lot of street guys and you need street guys. But, you know, Frank Costello did it the right way and died, you know, in his house. And you know what? At the end of the day, when it comes to going to prison, I mean, obviously, Frank Costello, you know, we haven't done his biography, and I'm not going to go too deep into it, but you know, he was pretty successful, ultimately. And we'll get into Frank Costello. He'll be a great episode, which I look forward to. That's a good question, actually. All right. Was there any significant mob presence in Baltimore? I heard no, but we do have a little Italy. Can't seem to find much when I Google it. Well, yeah. I mean, there were, like, quote-unquote splinter families that were in Baltimore. The Corbys were in control of Baltimore for, you know, a pretty long time. One of the families in New York that's always had a lot of connection in Baltimore was the Gambino family. You're really throughout the leadership in, you know, really since, you know, the Manganos. I mean, they had a crew in Baltimore. You know, Baltimore's obviously a port city. There was some help down there in, you know, obviously the ports and things like that. I know one of the big movers down there was Joanne Gallo. They were under the management of him. He was very close to the Corbys, and you know, they've always had kind of representation down there. But really, once you got into the 90s, they kind of went defunct. You know, Baltimore is a pretty interesting city. Obviously, there's a lot of black organized crime in Baltimore. If you know anything about, you know, we talked about it on the episode last week of Frank Matthews, whether it was Big Head Brother or Melvin Williams or Liddy Jones or any of those guys. You know, black organized crime obviously had a lot of connection up with Frank Matthews and the Philly Black Mafia. That was big there. Also Jewish mob with like Julius Salisbury. He was a gigantic loan shark bookmaker, kind of numbers guy in Baltimore. There were definitely mob leadership there for sure. And they kind of had their own, you know, crew, if you will. You know, it was just kind of one of those smaller cities, you know, kind of like a, you know, I mean, it's not even to the level. It would be the level of like Colorado or Seattle or one of those cities. Definitely had connections. There was definitely Cosa Nostra there. But, you know, by this point, it's extinct. Are there still a couple of guys down there maybe that are connected and maybe associates and things of that nature, probably in the DMV area? Yeah, for sure. 100%. All right. Let's move on. Do you know of any info on the Cray twins? Did they have any involvement with Cosa Nostra? Not that I know of. There was some talk that they were close with Angelo Bruno, but I don't know of any proof of that. For anyone that doesn't know, the Crays were two criminals that perpetrated crime in the East End of London. They were organized crime bosses, really kind of ruled the neighborhood, if you will. Not going to go into a deep soliloquy about them. But I think on Netflix, there was some things about the Crays, and if you want to research them, you can. But as far as I know, there was no connection to Cosa Nostra, as far as I know. Big Ron Previty died a couple of years ago. His book on infiltrating the Philly mob was one of the first mob books I've read, and it got me hooked. What do you say about Ron and his impact on organized crime? The Last Gangster. It's actually very good. It's a great book. I think it's Last Gangster. Yeah. George Anastasia, a good author. He's written some books that I don't agree with and I don't think he agrees with, but he wrote them and it is what it is. But as far as Big Ron Previty, look, I don't know if he had much of an impact. Look, he put John Stanfa away ultimately, but you know, I think John Veazey could have did that though. So I don't know if it would have been that big a deal. He didn't really do much in the way of bothering the Merlino group. I think the Merlino group were kind of in on who he was and what he was up to. Ron was a former cop, and I think people were always kind of wondering about his ultimatums and some of the things that he was ultimately about. So did he have an impact? Not really. I mean, he was an interesting guy. I always found him to be kind of interesting when he talked, but I don't know if he had much of an impact ultimately. Stanford would pretty much make anybody though. What do you know about the Philly meth connection in the 80s? Yeah. So I'm pretty up on this, obviously being from this area. So in the 80s, most of the meth that was being produced was run by a guy called Raymond Long John Mortarano. He was a soldier in the family. He had really went back to Angelo Bruno, and I mean, he had been around forever. I mean, he made a ton of money. He was the biggest meth dealer in the city. He was getting a ton of product, and he was moving a ton of product. And look, Bruno always had this hypocrisy, but he never really complained when he would get money from it. Eventually, Bruno obviously would get whacked. He would start to do business Mortarano with Nicky Scarfo. He would get in all sorts of beefs. He was close, though, with obviously the Greek mob. They kind of worked with him. He was close with the Junior Black Mafia, which came after the Philly Black Mafia. He knew motorcycle gangs. He was kind of connected with everyone. He was a huge drug dealer, Ultimately, he went to prison in the late 90s. You know, obviously all the stuff with Scarfo went down, and then he would get arrested. I think he did like 15 years. He eventually got out and started trying to take over gambling operations. Ultimately, though, I remember 2002, he was killed on Spruce Street, I believe it was, in Center City. And I don't think anyone was ever called for his murder. I remember he was driving a one of those Lincoln Town Cars, and I remember he was shot, and his car just went up over the curb and into the wall. It was right on Spruce, 7th and Spruce, I think it was. They would call this area the gayborhood. It's where, you know, obviously the gay bars and that kind of stuff is. But no one was ever called for his murder. I think it's still an unsolved homicide. So you have a couple of them in Philadelphia. But yeah, he was definitely a very big in the meth trade, one of the bigger ones. He was actually also very much aligned with the K&A gang, which if you know anything about Philadelphia, the K&A gang was basically the Westies, but in Philadelphia. They pretty much ran Kensington, Port Richmond. They were called the K&A gang because of their headquarters was right around Kensington and Allegheny. And back then, there were tons of Irish. It kind of started out as a burglary crew and then eventually started doing other things, selling drugs, getting involved in unions. They were very connected and that sort of thing, run by a guy called John Berkey, I think his name was. But yeah, pretty interesting group. And look, Mortarano was close with all those guys, you know, whether it was the Greeks, whether it was the K&A gang, or it was the Philadelphia Black Mafia. Everybody sold meth. And he was very much in a lucrative business, if you will. A couple more here. Why didn't the Gambinos move against the Albanians when they started taking over? So early 2000s, because they were scared of them. It's that simple. They'll never say it, but they were. The Albanians were a different breed. The Albanians were very similar, if we can connect it to an organization. Now, the Italian American mob in the Americas generally kept families. They kept citizens out of things. The Albanians did. There was a situation in the 2000s with Arnold Squitieri, who was the acting boss of the family at one point. He got into a beef with the Rudai organization, who were Albanian. And, you know, they went to a gas station to have a sit down. And the Albanians said, look, you either get with us or we'll blow this whole fucking place up. The Albanians at one point were very powerful. And you can say what you want about them, but they took what they wanted. They ruled with an iron fist, and eventually they're going to get out of prison. You know, eventually Alex Rudai, Nicola Deadeye, Lenny Colati, all these guys, they're going to get out of jail eventually. I think ultimately they didn't move on them because they were scared of them. It's that simple. The Albanians are tough to deal with. I remember, this is pretty interesting, but I remember there was a mob in Philadelphia. It was a Polish group called the Kielbasa Posse. It's a real group. And I remember they had a comment one point about Albanians. And they said they wouldn't work with them. They're just all over the place. You know, it's hard to work with them guys, but yeah, they were definitely a group. They were, I believe, out of Port Richmond. And at one point they were a group, but yeah, Albanians are tough to deal with. They're dangerous. They're real men for sure. Was there one family that had a bigger footprint in Vegas than the other families, or was it more of a shared territory? Well, yeah, look, I think everyone had their hands in it. But look, the Chicago outfit controlled Vegas. It's that simple. I don't think we really need to go much deep into that. And we'll eventually do some Vegas episodes. We got a casino episode we're going to do. And, you know, obviously talk about Tony Spilotro and that kind of stuff. So we'll talk about that more when we get to it. How involved is organized crime in unions? And what got you and Blackjack into these topics and doing a podcast? As far as how involved are they? Not as involved as they once were, but we just talked about it with the Colombo bus. They're still involved. You know, Matty Iannella, who we talked about with the Galanti stuff, he was very involved in unions up until, you know, he went away and ultimately died. But yeah, I mean, look, they're not in like they were back in the day, but you know, as we saw, they're still very much involved with unions. Unions are not as powerful as they once were, but they're still powerful. As far as what got me into this, you know, I've always been fascinated by the mafia and organized crime, really since I was a kid. And I had always meant to do this show. I just never really got around to it. And I figured when I was back at Barstool, I'd actually thought to do the show when I was there, and it just never got off the ground. I ended up getting a basketball podcast that kind of took up a lot of my time. And I never ended up doing it, but I said at the beginning of the year, you know what, I'm going to do this and we're going to see how it goes and we're going to rock with it. And, you know, for me, it's not about true crime. I don't really care much about like that kind of stuff. It's interesting, but for me, it's more about the organized aspect of it. And, you know, I feel like I know a lot, so why not share it? So that's a good question. I think we've answered that, but it's a good question to always go over. All right, we got two more. How connected was the mafia with drug cartels in Mexico and Cuba? Not at all. Not that I know of. The person also asked, did they have any conversations with Pablo Escobar or El Chapo? No, not that I know of. There was no connection to those guys and the mob. As far as Cuba, obviously, there was Cuban involvement. You know, if you know anything about, if you remember the Roy DeMeo episode, Chris Rosenberg tried to get involved with Cubans. Obviously, you know, Tony Salerno knew Cubans, not in the drug trade, but in the numbers business. Look, one thing about Cubans, they have huge number operations. Raymond Marquez had one. Jose Battle had one. You know, that was more their connection to the mob. As far as the drug trade, outside of the Rosenberg stuff, I don't know of anything. But when it comes to Cubans, definitely in the numbers business. If you know anything about Harlem, and you know, even with Frank Matthews, I mean, he was close with Raymond Marquez, Spanish Raymond, and Battle was obviously huge as well. All right, last question, and I saved this one for the end because this is probably the best question we've gotten. I think this is a great question. Shout out to Michael Ferguson. Really, an interesting question. You have to make a baseball team up made of mafia members. Who is on it? Who is at what position? 1 through 9 and a pitcher. So let me get into this. So the catcher for me would be Al Capone, 100%. Thought he kind of resembled the catcher, kind of porky, you know, kind of squat. Yeah, I think Carmine Galanti could have been a good one too. But, you know, I feel like he's kind of got to have a few brains. I feel like Al was smart enough. I think he can kind of like run an organization. He was kind of all over the place. He wasn't actually a mob guy. He could fight at any point. So yeah, I would say Al Capone would be my catcher. For pitcher, I think you go a couple ways here, but I'd go with Barney Belomo. The pitcher's kind of the cold, calculated guy. He's the guy that obviously is the leader, someone that can keep everyone together. He can be under the radar, but he can just be dead, you know, not deadly, but he's good at what he does. And I think, you know, Barney is good at what he does. Third base, you know, with hot corner, you got to have someone kind of smart, but kind of a goof as well, a little bit, kind of a little tough, you know, kind of a big bruising guy. I went Roy DeMeo here. I think you go with Casso as well. You know, third base, obviously you don't need to be uber talented. I guess in today's game you do, but you remember back in the day, even at first base as well, you have these kind of bruising guys. That was a tough one for me. Shortstop, kind of the leader of the infield. I went with Don Carlo Gambino. I could see maybe as a youngster, him playing baseball, kind of that, you know, little guy that can move around, you know, second base for that matter, small as well. I went with Joey Merlino. I could see Joey playing second base. And in fact, if you know anything about Joey, he was a baseball player. He played on a softball team sponsored by Gino's Cafe. Joey was a good athlete, great horse jockey at one point, a true story. So yeah, I would go with Joey and Don Carlo. I think that would have been a good kind of double play team. Joey and Don Carlo, that would have been interesting. First base, obviously, you know, they're the guys that get the outs. They're the guys that, you know, kind of complete everything. They make everything whole. They have to be smart. You know, they have to figure out, you know, who's stealing, that kind of stuff. I went with Chin Gigante, smart guy. I feel like in maybe in his younger years, I could have seen him playing first base, kind of a Jim Thome-esque type of body type, big dude. At one point, we knew Chin was a big guy. He was a boxer. So I would say Chin Gigante at first base. I feel like this outfield is as good as it gets, to be really honest. And I feel like we could do a whole show on this just because it's such a fascinating question. Center field, obviously, I think you go with like the best. You know, some of the great players in the history of baseball were in center field. So when we look at like Willie Mays, Mickey Mantle, Ty Cobb, Joe DiMaggio, you know, Mike Trout, you know, there were some really terrific and amazing baseball players that played in center field. I went with Lucky Luciano here, just kind of the number one. You know, Ken Griffey, you know, Willie, and you know, all these guys, just terrific. And I look at, you know, Lucky is kind of the figurehead of the American Mafia as far as it's worth. So I put him in center field. Left field, this is kind of a good one because you obviously want a good hitter here. You know, obviously some of the great left fielders were great hitters, whether it was Ted Williams who hit for average, or it was, you know, a guy like Barry Bonds or Kari Yastrzemski, or the great Babe Ruth, Willie Stargell, Ralph Kiner. You know, I think Stan Musial played left field, Pete Rose, all these guys that were just big boppers. Obviously Barry Bonds being one of them. I have to go with Joe Battistacardo, right? We know Joe could hit, right? We knew he could hit a bomb. I feel like with a nice fastball, Joe will put it into left field for sure. So I went with Joe Batters in left field. Right field, obviously a little bit more of a calculated hitter, kind of a smarter hitter. You know, whether it was you know, Roberto Clemente or Tony Gwynn or, you know, Hank Aaron or Reggie Jackson. I went with Meyer Lansky here. You know, kind of that calculated guy, smart, you know, just kind of an infield fill in there, or outfield fill in there. I actually threw in a manager as well. I threw Tony Salerno in as a manager. I mean, tell me you can't see Tony Salerno being a baseball manager, just sitting there eating sunflower seeds, telling people to go fuck themselves. I could see that. And I went with a bench coach as well, Neil Della Croce. I mean, the ultimate consigliere. Look, I think Tony could be a great bench coach as well, but yeah, I don't think anyone would beat that team, to be real honest with you. A really great question nonetheless. This is awesome, great question. Who gave this one again? Michael Ferguson. Awesome, really enjoyable. All right, let's get into John Martirano. This is a really interesting guy, John Martirano, because he was such a killer. And, you know, I feel like sometimes Boston gets left out just because it's not New York or whatever, but we'll let you have your own inference on what you think John Martirano is at the end. All right. John James Vincent Martirano was born December 13th, 1940. He was born in Somerville, Mass, which is just outside of Boston. I believe it's the northwest of Boston. His father was from Sicily. He was from Riese, in southern Sicily, and he had a lot of obviously homegrown Sicilian values, and he always taught John and his brother Jimmy to be, you know, to be stand-up men, to be men and to be Italian and to be ethical, but be tough and to be stringent on people. And, you know, really throughout John's life, that would become important to his code. John's mother was from Ireland. She had actually been from Somerville though, and when John's family came over in 1915, they settled in East Boston, and they would kind of meet his father and mother, and they would have two sons, Jimmy and obviously John. During John's childhood, he actually was very religious. His family was always very religious. John was an altar boy in his local Catholic church. And eventually during his kind of adolescence, Angelo Martirano would move his family to Milton, which is in Massachusetts. If you're a Barstool fan, I believe Milton was where Barstool's first office was. And I believe to this day, John Martirano still lives in Milton, weirdly enough. Growing up with John, his father, Angelo, actually had a business called Luigi's. It was a restaurant bar in the Combat Zone in Boston. And you know, if you know anything about the Combat Zone was a place that was really kind of like Times Square, like in basically the 70s. It was kind of a place for, you know, miscreants and prostitutes and pimps and gamblers and just kind of the den of iniquity, if you will, right? And he had a bar, and John, you know, into his high school years would hang out there. But that's where kind of he started meeting people. And it's interesting because now the Combat Zone is obviously no longer there. It's actually now Chinatown. It's actually a built up area, and it looks totally different. But in those days, it was a tough neighborhood. And, you know, John's father, Angelo, would obviously hobnob around. It wasn't really a mobster area, but, you know, you would meet people there. And this would become pretty important to John's kind of growth into the life. John would, throughout his high school career, kind of move around. He went to school in Rhode Island at Mount St. Charles Academy in Rhode Island. Him and his brother were actually great athletes. They were great football players. Particularly John. John was a running back. He, at one point in his high school career, eventually he would go to Milton High School, and he would actually get some college offers. But he decided in his senior season in 1958, once he graduated, that, you know, his father always told them, hey, you know, go in to get to work, provide for your family. You're the oldest son. This is your heritage. You got to take care of your family and be a man. And that's something that John would talk about in an interview he did with 60 Minutes. And he always had kind of said that he kind of knew this is where he would go, just because, you know, this is kind of the business. Not that his father was a murderer, but he was in a business that was obviously tough, and he would always kind of follow him into that. After kind of turning down the scholarships to play in college, John would start hanging around the Combat Zone. He was starting to hang out at Angelo, at the Luigi's Bar run by his father, Angelo. And this is where he would kind of meet gangsters. This is where he would meet Stephen Fleming. He would also become very close with Vincent Fleming, who was Stephen's brother, and they would kind of start palling around together. John would kind of start learning some of the tools of the trade. He would start hanging around. Look, Stephen Fleming was a criminal. It's pretty simple. He was very close with obviously big time criminals in Boston, like Howie Winter and other people like that. In 1965, John would have his first son, and Vincent Fleming would be the godfather. So they were obviously very close. Down the road, John would have another child, and Whitey Bulger would be the godfather. So, you know, John and these guys were close. They had a great relationship. All four brothers, John and Jimmy Martirano, and then Stephen and Vincent Fleming, they were all very close. But John would start getting under the auspice of Fleming. And by the mid years of his 20s, he was becoming a killer. By 24, John was tasked with his first murder. And John would always say, I was not a hitman. I did conflict resolution, according to him. And there was an individual, Robert Palladino, who was part of the Patriarch crime family. He was a made man. And he was involved in something with a murder at Luigi's. A prostitute was killed. People were worried that Palladino was going to start cooperating with the feds. So John Martirano was ordered to kill a Palladino. He was found under an overpass with bullets in his head. And that was, quote, popping his cherry. John was a killer. One of his more prolific kills would come in 1968. And this would be kind of a problem for John Martirano. He would talk about this years later, that he felt he went a little too far with this murder. In 1968, Stephen Fleming is in a bar in Boston, and he gets attacked by two mobsters, Rocco Lamattina and John Cincotti. They beat him up in this after-hours spot. Helping them was an individual called Hubert Smith. Hubert Smith was a black male. He, I guess, was some sort of bouncer, if you will, but he starts getting in, sneaking punches, that sort of thing. Martirano finds out about this. Fleming is furious, and he orders Martirano to kill this Smith. But before, he kind of questions Smith about what went on, and you know, all he wanted, quote, from him was the right answers. This Smith guy starts becoming really arrogant and just not answering his questions. So John just says, okay, fine. See you later. He would track Smith to a car in Dorchester. In the car was a woman and a 17-year-old man called Douglas Barrett. At that point, Martorano would pull out a .38 revolver and kill all three occupants in the car. So, you know, obviously John Martorano didn't need to kill the other two, but he did. You know, I think this was something that was obviously, you know, not needed. Hubert Smith was obviously way out of line, but I feel like he went a little too far with killing the witnesses. But again, I think John Martorano, and this would happen down the road, sometimes these people that get involved with things that they shouldn't get involved with, they're collateral damage and they have to go sometimes. And I think he recognized that. So look, by John Martorano's 28th birthday, he was a killer of multiple people. He was a bona fide hitman. And this would really just be the beginning. In 1972, he, along with other individuals, including Whitey Bulger, Howie Winter, and Stephen Flemmy, would form the Winter Hill Gang and would basically take over the hierarchy of that group. Now, the Winter Hill Gang would control literally everything. They would control gambling. They would control loan sharking. They would control everything. And the perfect guy to take care of business in the case where someone wouldn't deal with something or they had to be killed was John Martorano. He was the chief enforcer of the Winter Hill Gang. In 1973, John would make some mistakes, though. There was a gang in Boston called the Notarengellis. They were a small gang that was kind of battling for turf. They were kind of battling for supremacy. They were starting to kill people they shouldn't. And this individual, Indian Al Notarengelli, who was the leader of the gang, they were from Somerville. They kill a bookie who's close to Gennaro Angulo, who was close with the Winter Hill Gang. They had affiliation. They were allies at one point. They tell John Martorano, hey, this Indian Al guy is out of control. He's got to go. So John's tasked with killing Indian Al, and he takes the hit. The problem was John becomes very emboldened by this point. He goes in and kills a bar owner by mistake. And the bar owner, I guess, according to John Martorano, looked like this guy, Michael Milano, it was his name. He drove a car that was similar to this guy, and John Martorano mistakenly killed him. He would eventually, though, catch not only Indian Al, but Al's brother, Indian Joe, who fled to Medford, Mass. But John found him, dressed as a construction worker. He walked into a coffee shop and executed Indian Joe. Eventually, he would catch up to Indian Al as well, and he would shoot him in the head. And this was only after Indian Al tries to make a peace offering to the Angulos. The Angulos basically tell him to go fuck himself, and he kills Indian Al in 1974. So, you know, this ends up, instead of just killing Indian Al, he kills Indian Al's brother and a random guy that just looked like Indian Al or had a car that was similar to Indian Al. John Martorano, by this point, in 1978, John Martorano killed 18 people. He was a mass murderer, if you will. But again, he was becoming very confident. He was emboldened. In 1979, we talked about this in the Whitey Bulger episode. John Martorano, as well as others, including Stephen Flemmy and Howie Winter, would be indicted in a horse racing scheme involving an individual called Fat Tony Ciula. Ciula was a kind of a race fixer. He was always at the track, and he would become a witness and testify against Bulger, Flemmy, Martorano, Winter, everybody. John gets wind of this and goes to Florida, and he kind of takes shop down there and lives under an assumed name. His assumed name, funny enough, was Richard O'Coin. That was his nondescript name in his new life. And he would actually kind of stay away for a while. He wouldn't get caught. We'll talk about obviously when he got caught. But during this time that he's down in Florida, John Martirano is still occasionally killing people for the Winter Hill gang. They would just call him and say, hey, look, this guy has to go. Go do it. In 1981, Richard Wheeler is the target. And we talked about Wheeler. Wheeler was a big wig. He was a part of he was the CEO of Telex. He was the owner of this World Highlight organization that Bulger was trying to muscle in on. World Highlight was obviously a big moneymaker as far as gambling. Bulger was trying to muscle in on that. And, you know, Roger Wheeler was in the way. So Bulger goes and calls Martirano and says, hey, look, I need you to leave sunny Florida, go to Tulsa, to this country club and whack Roger Wheeler. I'm sorry. You'll get the information from an FBI agent that we have. And according to John Martirano, an individual, Paul Rico, who was an FBI agent, gave him info on where he could find Roger Wheeler. According to Martirano, he literally just drove into a country club, waited for Wheeler in the parking lot, walked up to him, put a bullet in his head, and that was that. A year later, he would also tie up a loose end by killing a businessman that was connected to the Winter Hill gang and close to Roger Wheeler. Called John Callahan. And according to Bulger and obviously under Martirano in his witness statements, he would discuss that this guy Callahan was a loose end and he had to go. And it was just kind of collateral damage, kind of like the two people in the car when he killed Hubert Smith. During this time, a few years later, I mentioned John Martirano would have another son, Jimmy, and Whitey would be godfather. So they were still very close. We obviously know what happens in the early 90s. Whitey gets some information that an indictment's coming down, and he's one step ahead, leaves the city of Boston, and was on the run until, obviously, what was it, 2013, and we all know what happened to Whitey Bulger. John Martirano would actually not get arrested, though, until 1995. He would be arrested in Boca Raton, Florida. He would actually was a fugitive for a pretty long time, but 16 years. Remember, he had become a fugitive in 79. So he was away for a long time. And by this point, like I said, he was committing murders. He was doing all sorts of things. At that point, he gets arrested and the FBI pulls him into the room and says, hey, look, John, we got something to tell you. You know who that guy is? Of course I know who that guy is. It's Whitey Bulger. Well, hey, we got something to tell you. He's been an informant since the 70s. And your boy Flemmy was right there with him. Martirano says, well, he's ratting against me. They say, yes. So John says, well, fuck this. Then I'm going to rat. I'm going to not only rat on him, I'm going to rat on Flemmy, and I'm going to rat on that shitbag John Connolly, who we talked about during the Bulger episode. Again, this is not a Bulger episode, so we're not going to get into all of Whitey's stuff. If you want to listen to that episode, you can go listen to it. We did it, I think it was episode 9. But John Martirano basically says, fuck this. I'm not taking the fall for these fucks. And I got to tell you, I've always said when it comes to becoming a rat, there are one or two guys that I look back and say, okay, I get it. Look, did John Martirano kill a lot of people? Yeah. I mean, he says he killed 20 people. He confessed to 20 murders, but I'm guessing he probably killed 40 or 50 people. When you look at people that rat on their family members, whether it was Joe Messina, whether it was John Aylett, whether it's Gene Barella, whether it's Larry Mazza, whether it's Jimmy Calandra, whether it's, you know, little Al Diarco, whoever. Every case is different. Now, is a rat a rat? Yes. But if you ask John Martirano, are you a rat? He would tell you, no, I'm not. And I will tell you, and I mean this, there are two people in the history of the mob that I understand, well, actually three, I understand. Fat Peter Chiodo, John Martirano, and Larry Mazza. And in all those cases, there was either a boss above them going to testify against them and was selling them out the entire time. You mean to tell me John Martirano is going to do the rest of his life for two shitbags that were doling him out for 20 years? I mean, I'm not going to say what John Martirano did was okay, but I'm also going to try to rationalize it a little bit. John Martirano would say, never informed. I didn't rat on anyone. I became a government witness. According to him, there's a difference between being a government witness and a rat. He also stated that a rat is someone that does it behind your back and doesn't have the balls to do it in front of you in court. A witness is someone that gets on the stand and just tells people what happened, and he can face his people. Whether you agree with that or not, I'm not saying I agree with that. But I do have some sort of, I don't know what the word I'm looking for. Do I have the understanding of why I did it? Yeah, I do. Eventually, John Marrano would agree to a plea deal and get a 14-year sentence for 20 murders. Keep in mind, he would be arrested in 1995. And by 2007, he was released from prison after 12 years inside. So for 20 murders, he got 12 years. That equates to about 7 months per murder. And again, I mean, it's conceivable to believe John Marrano killed more than 20 people. I don't know why, though, he would leave it out, just because it was all in the same cooperation agreement. John eventually would also testify in 2008 at the murder trial of John Connolly. Keep in mind, John Connolly, up until recently, was in prison. I believe he got charged with second-degree murder. And I think he got out, I believe, last year, I think, for due to coronavirus. He did a lot of damage, John Martorano. But I'll tell you this, he did a lot of damage to shitheads like Stephen Fleming, who was a piece of shit. Whitey Bulger was a piece of shit. He was a child molester. He was a terrible person. And John Connolly, who was a corrupt piece of shit FBI agent, probably the most piece of shit corrupt FBI agent we've ever seen. I've always found John Martorano to be oddly compelling. I mean, I'm not a big Kevin Weeks guy. I mean, he's kind of interesting, but I found John Martorano, he doesn't do many interviews, but I always found him to be pretty compelling. I think his book's quite good. I think he's a fascinating individual. To this day, John Martorano is on the streets. And from what I understand, he lives in Milton, right in the little town in Massachusetts. He has, I think, 5 children. He's an old man at this point. I think he's 80, 81, something like that. But he's a fascinating guy. This is a guy that has no qualms about what he did. He didn't go into witness protection. He did his time. And I mean, he's not out on the internet making videos about it, this and that. He did what he had to do. He did an interview or two, he wrote a book, and that was that. And, John Martorano would never talk to me. I don't think he would talk to anybody really, but, an interesting guy, nonetheless. I mean, he was a prolific killer. He was a killer that, I think was very emboldened. I think he sometimes did a little too much, obviously with killing people that he really didn't need to. But when you're in this life, you're going to kill people that maybe are just collateral damage. The truth of the matter is, when it came to that Herbert Smith murder, those two people in that car could identify him. And he took care of loose ends. So the whole mantra that mobsters don't kill innocent people, that's not true. John Martorano killed a few innocent people. So that's John Martorano. Not a super long biography, but really an interesting one nonetheless. We don't hear as much about, obviously we know about Whitey Bulger, but we don't hear as much about kind of his counterparts like Fleming and Kevin Weeks and Martorano. But Martorano was a dangerous individual. I always found him to be very demented looking. I mean, he's just kind of that fat guy, but he was just that fucking powerful dude, man. I wouldn't want to get on his bad side, put it that way. He would use disguises. He was just very feared, very feared. It's funny. I was talking to a friend of mine, Madawaska Rob, shout out to him. I know he's listening. He was talking about how he thinks it's crazy because he works in Milton, Mass, and Martorano just walks around the streets like it's nothing. It's kind of wild. I know a lot of the listeners, I know a lot of the Kirk, the Mina fans are fans of the show. And, I know a lot of these guys are from Somerville and they're from Boston and they're from Milton, those areas. So it's kind of crazy. And I did want to kind of shout out to those guys. I know a couple of them kind of gave me a little heat for the Bulger episode. Look, I'll be honest, guys. I don't know Boston as much as New York and Philly and that kind of area. I feel like I know a good amount about Bulger, but there's a couple of geography things I got wrong, but a fascinating group nonetheless. They all told on each other at the end of the day. But yeah, look, if I'm John Martorano, I got to tell you, and you can call me a whatever you want. If I were Martorano and I did, you know, years of killing people on behalf of an organization, and I found out the entire time they were cooperating, I don't know. I would have a hard time going to prison for that. But again, I guess you could also make the case that John Martorano knew what he was doing. He killed those people. You know, he made the decision to get into that life, and he should pay for his crimes. So that's where we can say, well, he is a rat, and he's a bad person. But look, I don't think anyone will argue that John Martorano wasn't a bad person, but that's the show for this week. Obviously a show that I was prepared for. I wasn't prepared to do alone, but I think I did a pretty good job of it. Before we go, I do want to tell all of you, and I urge you, I think it's important that we show love to our sponsors. And I want to tell you about OmertaMia.com. If you're someone that enjoys living your life by somewhat of a code, you know, you don't like rats and you try to live your life by not calling the police all the time, shit like that, you got to go check out OmertaMia.com, OmertaMia.com. If you love some of the shirts that I wear, you know, Stop Glorifying Rats, the Phone Police Informants, the Capone shirt, the Omerta definition, all that stuff came from Omerta Mia clothing. They've got hats, they've got stickers, they've got artwork, they've got t-shirts, they've got sweatshirts, they've got all sorts of stuff. If it's something that you buy into and you enjoy, make sure you go check them out right now. Go support them. They're great people. Chris and the boys over there, they gave us a great promo code. If you go to OmertaMia.com right now, you enter promo code sit down 20, all one word, you're going to get 20% off your total purchase. Go show love to our sponsors. In the coming weeks, we're going to add some other sponsors as well. We signed a deal recently with a company that's going to help us get more ads and kind of get us paid on some of this stuff. You know, we've been doing this show for free. We don't ask that you pay anything for the show. We just ask that you show love to our sponsors. You know, go check these people out. Go check these companies out. You know, eventually we got to pay bills here, and we've got to pay. I have a producer, you know, I want to make a little money out of this. You know, this isn't easy to sit here, and you know, these shows take some time to put together. So, you know, show love to our sponsors. Check out Thrive Fantasy if you love fantasy football. They've got great contests. Check out Omerta Mia. Check out the sponsors we have in the future. It would mean a lot to me, and it's not us asking a lot for a show that we do for free. That's that for the show this week. Next week, we'll be back. I'm sure Blackjack will be back. Vito Rizzuto. It's going to be a good one. Obviously, if you've heard Drake's recent CD, Certified Lover Boy, I guess there's not CDs anymore, but his album, Certified Lover Boy, there's a song called 7 a.m. on Bridal Path. And in the song, he makes a comment that he's made north of the border like Vito Rizzuto. And it's become very big because Drake's huge. And, you know, I've got some people that have wanted me to do Vito. So we're going to talk about the Sixth Family and Vito Rizzuto, an interesting guy. And we'll spend next week on a pretty long show. We won't have a Q&A or anything. But thanks for listening, everybody. As always, I appreciate it. I thank all of you for listening. I'm so happy that this show is doing well and we're doing something with it. I hope you enjoy what we're doing, and show love. Go follow us on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. Give us a 5-star review, a comment. Let us know what you think. And we'll see you next week here on the Sit Down. Have a great night. Bye-bye.